How's that? It's better. We need to start a little tradition here. I want everyone to look at Denny when I read these stories. The Reverend Billy Graham tells of a time early in his ministry when he arrived in a small town to preach a revival meeting. Wanting to mail a letter, he asked a young boy where the post office was. When the boy had told him, Dr. Graham thanked him and said, "If you'll come to the church this evening, you can hear me give directions on how to get to heaven." "I don't think I'll be there," the boy replied. "You don't even know how to get to the post office." Now, you liked that story, didn't you?
Proper context.
This wasn't the right context for that?
I'll leave that to others to decide.
Some people are just no fun. All right, well, today we finish up our short series that I have titled, "He Who Helps the Needy Honors the Lord," taken from Proverbs 14:31. And my plan today is to talk a little bit about short-term mission trips. And I was originally thinking about wrapping things up, talking about those scenarios that I started the series off with a couple weeks ago, but probably won't really have time for that. But first, let's do a quick review. Perhaps we might think of these as these 6 points here as the 6 cardinal rules, so to speak. For the sake of time, I'm just going to list these without further comment, trusting that just by mentioning them, you'll be able to recall everything that was said last week, every example, every application, every scripture, everything. How's that? And if you missed last week, there weren't any Michael Jackson tribute bands in the area or anything, was there? So most people would have been here last week, but I did that for you, Tom. You missed last week, and the week before that. And it's good to have you today. Did you need a GPS to learn how to get back here? Just at the Boylan Street. All right. I'm sorry. Here we go. Honor the Lord by helping the needy, number one. Number two, address the cause of the poverty itself, not the symptoms. Number three, when it comes to poverty alleviation, do not do for others what they can do for themselves. Number four, discern what is actually needed, relief, rehabilitation, or development. There is a difference in each of those. And we need to recognize our own poverty and be as shrewd as snakes. So that's the shortest review I've ever given, ever. Today, we are going to talk about short-term mission trips, and by short-term, basically talking about those trips you take a group of people, usually a youth group, but not always a youth group, to perhaps a third world country for something along the lines of a week, maybe 2 weeks, maybe possibly 3. Given the fact that a fair number of our folks here have been on such mission trips, and several on more than one, this could be the most controversial message of the series, if not the most controversial of the year, but probably not the most controversial ever. But if you have gone on a trip yourself, but if you haven't gone on a trip yourself, and you don't think you ever will, chances are someone you know, usually a member of a youth group somewhere, will plan to go and will hit you up for a donation to help fund the expenses. So we're all kind of involved in this one way or another. And chances are high that almost all of us here have been pretty much conditioned to think of short-term mission trips as noble adventures where there are people in need who are helped, and the people going are spiritually enriched by the experience, and overall it's assumed that the kingdom of God is expanded in all of this. My first missions trip took place way back in the 70s, before most folks here were even born. A church in Fort Recovery, Ohio was putting together a team to build a church facility in the Dominican Republic. How many know where the Dominican Republic is? Okay. Where is it? Derek, where is it? You raised your hand? Oh, you raised your finger. Gray, where is it? Someone. Okay. It's Haiti and Dominican Republic share the same island. Okay, down there south of Cuba. Anyway, they needed brick masons, or more technically block masons, and a friend of mine heard about it, and he was planning on going, and eventually he talked me into it, and I ended up being the only Mason on the team. Spending 10 days in a third world country was quite an experience, one that I would recommend for every American, especially Christians. And when I came home, I promised that I would never complain about anything ever again. Right? That lasted about 3 days, which is pretty good for me, but I do remember making the promise. Unlike some mission trips, ours was not a vacation masqueraded as a missions trip, which is a common practice. We worked sun up to sundown and worked hard. Conditions were very primitive. There's no electricity on the job site. Everything had to be done by hand. Even the blocks used to build the church were made on the job site. The only other mission trip I've ever been on is the one that everyone here is aware of. 3 summers ago, in 2009, Seth and I took a number of our youth group to Mexico. We spent a week in a city about the size of Fort Wayne called San Luis Potosí, where my sister actually lives there as a missionary. And we stayed in what you might call a youth complex home. Our youth home complex, and we gave the outside a complete paint job and made several repairs. We also helped with different VBS programs in town, passed out food and blankets to areas that were especially poverty-stricken. In comparison, the area we went to in Mexico, though quite poor, was not as poor as the one I went to in the Dominican Republic. In the past year or so, I've asked myself, if I've had to do these two mission trips all over again, what would I do differently? In fact, this question never even showed up on my radar until I read chapter 7 of the book I referred to last week, When Helping Hurts. The authors talked about their own experiences on the mission field, and I could connect and relate to many of their observations. And I read the chapter, I've read it now several times, and have mulled over the points quite a bit. And I have asked myself, what would I do differently? And there's a lot of ways to answer that question, but one answer that I actually flirt with the most is this. If I had to do it all over again, I probably wouldn't go. Was there great value in going? Absolutely. Did people benefit from these trips that I took and my involvement? I believe so. Was the experience itself enriching? No question about it. Any regrets for going? I don't have any. But if given the option to do it again, I don't know that I would. I probably wouldn't. Short-term mission trips, this is a tricky area. When you compare the pros with the cons, it isn't always clear whether they do more harm or more good. And unfortunately, the cons, the potential harms, are seldom talked about or even acknowledged or, for that matter, even recognized. Some of the more obvious reasons for going on a short-term mission trip, the pros include the opportunity to experience life in a third world country. The opportunity to serve others in need, making relationships with some of the indigenous people, to whet one's appetite for long-term missions work, and, of course, to deepen one's own commitment to Christ. But the fact is, each of those benefits can be attained through other avenues other than a short-term missions trip, and such avenues can often be more effective and less expensive. Now, to be clear, it is not my plan today to discourage these sorts of endeavors, to put them down, or to suggest that the whole practice should be ditched. Not at all. But certain questions should be asked. It's like everything else. Christians are called to be generous and kind and benevolent and sacrificial and giving. Yet with that, we are also expected to be wise and discerning. Not all poverty is created equal. Not all ways to alleviate poverty are created equal. Not all charitable organizations are created equal, as we've been talking about. And not all mission trips are created equal. And I have prepared 5 such questions for us to go over today, 5 questions I wished I would have asked or asked in a more thorough way, and 5 questions that if we ever go on a missions trip here again, organizing the youth group, for instance, questions that I would expect parents to ask me or Nate, if Nate is still with us at that time. I am so mean. How many like it that I'm mean? I mean, really, don't you find that charming that I'm mean? Right. First question, pretty obvious but very important. And it deserves to be pushed and really fleshed out. What's the purpose exactly? What is the mission? What is it that's going to justify all the time and effort, not to mention the expense? And could this purpose actually be better achieved another way? These are the kinds of questions that if you ask them, well, you can expect to get the look. You know, you will be perceived as though you're a Scrooge or someone who's wound up too tight about everything or someone who just wants to tear apart everything that is good. And the response is often a frown and a sigh. You know, how many have gotten that look? You know what that is? How many started to get more of those looks once you got involved here? All right. We just kind of have that effect. Follow with me here. If the purpose is to pass out food in a poverty-stricken area, then doesn't it make more sense to work through churches and organizations already established there? I mean, consider just the money spent on airfare alone. Think what could be done if all of that had now been made available, distributed through local churches or charities who are best equipped to meet the needs in their communities. Do we really need to fly a couple dozen people to Guatemala to pass out bags of food and run down villages? If the purpose is to build or renovate a church facility or orphanage or some other worthy building, would it not make more sense to hire local workers in that particular neighborhood? Are we the only ones who can lay block, paint walls, and cut boards with a saw? In fact, this whole thing's kind of a double-edged sword. Not only is there a significant cost involved to fly Americans into the country, but once we get there, we actually take work away from those who really need it. If we hired local workers instead, we would end up investing in their economy. In 2006, the last year I have any statistics for, $1.6 billion was spent on short-term mission trips by Americans alone. No doubt much of that money was a good investment, but how much of it wasn't? If the purpose is to experience a third world country and make friends with indigenous people, then the question is this about them or about us? What is this really? There is great value in experiencing a third world country. Again, I highly recommend it for everyone. But if that is really the objective, then go there on vacation instead. Take a group. Do some service projects if you want. But let's not call it a missions trip, and let's not ask the church and other people to give money toward it. Let's reserve the term missions trip and our support and involvement in them for those endeavors where the sole objective is to minister to others, and let's be sure that an actual trip is the best means to do that ministry. As silly as it sounds, the first question that should come to mind is actually this: is the trip even needed? For instance, as Americans, we define poverty a whole lot different than the rest of the world. I mean, we really do. Poverty to us means living in a trailer court, driving a 20-year-old car, and having only one television in the house. And so with all of our good intentions, we want to go into areas of the world where the standard of living is less than ours and try to fix things that really don't need fixed. The people there are quite content. They have food and water, they have shelter, their basic needs are met, they are happy. They just simply do not place the same value on material goods as we do. But we see pictures of huts on the brochure and dirt sidewalks and chickens running around in the front yard, and immediately we want to respond to the call to help. Do they really need our help? Do they even want it? Sometimes yes, indeed, but not always. Thus, the need to ask the right questions. Here's one for you. Think the church facility I helped to build in the Dominican Republic. It became obvious after a few days that we were building something that no one had even asked for. There was no congregation in place praying for a church to meet in. It was all part of the denomination's church growth strategy. You know the strategy. If we build it, they will come. And what it came down to was actually this, a race with other denominations to see who could boast of having the most churches in that country. In fact, that's what I heard all week long. I wasn't a member of that denomination, but I heard it all week long, nonstop bragging about that very thing. We are number one down here, 45 more churches than the Baptists, 100 more than the Methodists. Numbers, of course, that play a significant role in fundraising efforts back home. As you can see, this is a typical American approach by a typical American denomination. Second question, who will be in charge? Once on the field, who will be directing the day-to-day affairs and assignments? Is this something where Americans will be coming under the authority of the local leadership, or will the Americans be running the show? It's a significant question. It may be hard for us to believe, but you know what? Local leaders oftentimes know better about how to get things done in their own hometown. Americans who are used to running the show want to do business the way that they do back home and often just make things worse. There's a clash of cultures, a clash of values, and all sorts of examples could be used to illustrate this. Locals, for instance, will go to the neighborhood lumber yard and spend all afternoon there just to buy a truckload of lumber. That kind of thing would just drive me crazy, but it's common. And that's because relationships and community life is a higher priority than setting deadlines and meeting them. Americans just want to get in and get out. Put it on the visa. Hurry it up if you can. You know, we don't want to hang around talking about the birthday party coming up for the owner's granddaughter that weekend. But this impersonal, let's just do business, I've got things to do, which is common in our culture, is oftentimes perceived as being rude in other cultures, leaving a bad taste in the mouth of locals, and can even have a negative effect on the ministry of the mission team. You know, we're turning off the very people that we come to serve. Again, tons and tons of examples could be given here. But there are other considerations as well. Unless locals are in charge, taking ultimate responsibility for the project, they aren't going to value the ministry of the mission nearly as much. It will be seen as though we are just doing something to them because we Americans know better and they should just get out of our way and let us help them. Paternalism, as we talked about last week. One pastor in a third world country compared help from the Americans to the folk story of an elephant dancing with a mouse. The elephant meant well, but in the dance, he killed the mouse. He was just simply too big. Americans and their way of doing things in other cultures are often too big, too fast, too over the top, too driven, and too insensitive to their surroundings, as in the values and customs of that culture. I was guilty of this when we went to Mexico. The first day there, I was eager to get together a list of all the projects that needed to be done and set forth a plan of attack. I had an army of volunteers, this whole youth group at my disposal, and was eager to organize things and put them to work. It was difficult for you to picture, but I really felt that. My sister, Amy, was quick, gentle, but quick to set things straight, telling me that Brajito, the pastor that we came down to serve, was the one in charge, and that he will lay out the projects each day. My initial thought was, being an American, but he needs me to do that for him. That's why I'm here. You know, the fact is, actually, this is kind of a typical attitude for American missionary teams. Because we come from a culture of abundance, we have this subtle belief that we know how to do things better than cultures that are less prosperous. Not only do the locals know better about what is needed, but they also know better about how to go about meeting those needs. And what they need from us is actually to let them. The purpose of the mission trip is to serve, not to take over. Take my experience in Dominican Republic. We have 10 days to build a church. Deadlines have to be met. The American team that runs the operation knows how to do that, for they do it all the time. And to meet that deadline, well, fill in the blank, Dave. To meet that deadline, what are you going to have to do? Cut corners, right? How are you going to build something in 10 days unless you cut corners? And there isn't, and since there isn't anyone local in charge that we are doing the work for, someone who has a vested interest in making sure things are done right, well, of course, corners are going to be cut. I wasn't even needed there as a mason. In fact, everybody was on the wall laying block. People just plopped mortar on blocks with their hands, like little kids at a beach, you know, and just laid one block on top of the other. And it didn't matter if they were straight or not. Levels weren't used, no plumb lines, no measurements. Just get the walls up. We just got to get the walls up. Come on, everybody, let's just get the walls up. It drove me crazy, but... The roof itself was made of concrete, which was mixed on the job site and wheeled up using a long ramp and wheelbarrows, and it was basically a large sidewalk slab with no reinforcements underneath it. And when the whole thing was finished, I was fearful to walk under it. But this is what you face with a 10-day deadline and no church, local church involved to insist otherwise. And we got caught. The city inspector came and ordered us to tear the whole thing down and start over, and he wanted it done right. But the project manager, an American who was hired by the denomination to build all of these churches in the Dominican Republic, pulled out a wad of cash and handed it to the inspector. Work resumed immediately. Now, it may be that the city inspector was expecting a bribe, and this is all part of his scam. But nevertheless, the building really was a sham. If there was ever an argument for a mission trip to come under the leadership of a local church, this would be it. Flying home, I had visions of a gust of wind, you know, blowing the whole thing over and killing everyone inside. But given the fact that no one even wanted this church, it's probably just stood there empty all those years, and that was not a major concern. This leads to another important question, somewhat similar. How will the local people be involved? Is this something we are doing to them, for them, or with them? Let's go back to our trip in Mexico. You may remember that before we went, we talked about one poor area where people actually lived at the city landfill. The men would dig through the trash each day looking for anything that could be recycled and sold, and this is how they provided for their families. And when we talked about this here, our church responded. We raised hundreds of dollars so that we could buy food and blankets down there and distribute them to some of these needy families. And that's exactly what we did. In fact, you may remember some of the pictures that were taken. Youth group kids handing out sacks of goodies to all the moms and kids there in front of the shanties that they lived in. And the whole thing was pretty exciting. The kids were elated, the moms showing their gratitude with smiles and tears. But sometimes it's what you don't see in a picture that tells the story. What you didn't see were the husbands and fathers. In fact, anywhere we went to hand out such goods to poor families, men never showed themselves. The reason became obvious to me once we got back home and I started to think about it. Imagine a caravan of wealthy dudes from Wall Street stopping by your house with cameras, holding up, handing you a sack of groceries on your doorstep. What's the message? You poor thing. You can't even provide for your own family. Good thing I'm here to help you. Let's all say cheese. While the men may have been grateful for the food and blankets, they were obviously embarrassed. You know, if we were to do it all over again, I would have suggested another course of action. I would have said to my sister, we don't want to do something to these people or for these people, but with these people. Let us spend the day out in the landfill with the men digging through the smelly trash and rubble. We will fight off the flies and maggots with them. They can teach us what they do, what to look for, and what has value. We will then toss our findings into the same truck, and our plunder will be mixed with theirs. I mean, if you want to make relationships with indigenous people, what better way than to actually work with them side by side, all day long in the same conditions? Here, the attitude would be more of a go as a learner rather than a go and help save them. Now, on the flip side is what took place back at the youth home where we stayed. One of the projects was to paint the outside and take care of the repairs. It was a worthy task, and we all dug in and got the job done. However, The college-age kids who lived there at that home stayed in their rooms the whole time playing video games on their computers. Obviously, they should have been out there with us. You know, now, this is not the kind of thing you can address once you're on the field, but it is a question that should be discussed before you sign up. You know, on any mission trip, will we be working with the people on all the projects? Are they a part of the team as well? If not, then again, the question is, why would we do something for others that they can do for themselves? It hurts them, it hurts us, and as we explained last week, they have to take some ownership in this or they will never value it. They never will. In fact, I actually suspect that the screens and the doors and windows that Josh Birch and I replaced that day have probably since been carelessly pushed in and ripped through. There would have been no incentive to do otherwise. The fourth big question needs to be asked is this. Who gets to go on the trip? How is that decided? What sort of screening process is there? With this, again, we have to keep in mind the goals and objectives. If it is to physically build a church, then we would expect the team to consist of people with skills of construction. However, it's typically everyone is invited, everyone gets to go, we'll find something useful for you, it's no big deal whether you know what you're doing or not. If the purpose of the mission team is to provide medical care to those hit by a natural disaster, then we would expect the team to consist of nurses and doctors or people who at least have some experience in the medical field. But again, that's not usually the case. If it is to clean up debris from an earthquake or hurricane to help open up roads and prepare for the rebuilding of the community, then I'm just going to be frank here. We would expect the team to be made up of men who aren't afraid of getting dirty, young and strong, and not teenage girls afraid of breaking a fingernail. Around 20 people went on this mission trip to the Dominican Republic that I went on. Only about 15 of them even worked. One guy was depressed because a loved one had recently died, and he never even came to the job site. Two or three were teenage girls who weren't suited for the type of work we were doing. And I forget the reasons for the others. But the question is, why were they even allowed to come? Churches and Christians invested in them, raised money for their airfare and so on, and yet they didn't do anything the whole time. Now, I felt bad for the guy who was depressed, but why was he on the mission trip? Again, this kind of thing is not that uncommon. But there needs to be more to the screening than simply job skills. Second part of this, you know, more beyond job skills and an ability to work. Spiritual maturity would also be essential. Members of a mission team are going in the name of Christ, representing him, and they are also representing a church or some other Christian organization. And so we would expect, at the minimum, a recommendation from the pastor or elders, references from other believers weighing in on the character and commitment of the applicant. I would think that we would want to know if the person is committed to their local church body and how they are involved in that church. That would give great insight into what to expect from them once on the mission field. But this kind of screening, again, unfortunately, is quite rare. And this is because, again, I think it is because we have the whole thing backwards. Instead of focusing on how we can best meet the needs of the indigenous people themselves and who would be best qualified to do that, we are more oriented toward highlighting a spiritual experience for those who are going. And so we even encourage immature believers to sign up, thinking that this will be a life-changing experience for them, deepening their faith. Again, it's supposed to be about them, not us. If it is about them, as it is claimed on the brochures, then why aren't we more fussy about who goes on these trips? This is a mistake we made in our trip to Mexico in 2009. We opened it up to all the kids in the youth group and ended up including a few who weren't a part of the group. And we should have been more discriminating, and this became obvious once we got down there. We had a handful of kids who were a handful. Their commitment to Christ at best was shallow, and their resistance to the rules caused problems. And they came not to serve, but to take in the experience itself. And last summer, I ran into one of those kids, and he asked me if we were going to Mexico again. He wanted to go. And he said, that was one of the most fun things I've ever done. He just disqualified himself by using that sentence, you know. I wanted to say, even if we were to go, you won't be, but I didn't. There are other ways to help immature believers become Holy Spirit-filled, radicalized warriors of the Most High, transformed children of the everlasting kingdom, empowered by fire and spirit and glory, than a missions trip. That's not the time, it's not the place. We don't send a high school kid who is lazy with his homework into an operating room to do brain surgery, hoping that the experience will somehow inspire him to be a better student. We have more respect for the patient than that. And we need to show that same kind of respect to people in third world countries by not sending them our immature Christians. In addition to job skills and spiritual maturity, there's another kind of screening that needs to take place as well. What we might call cultural sensitivity. Some people shouldn't go for reasons that may not sound very compelling to us, but are sound reasons nonetheless. And again, if it is about them and not about us, then it shouldn't matter whether those reasons seem justified or not. Let me give you an example. Tattoos. Here in America, tattoos are a sign of being cool. It's so common these days that we think nothing of them. But not so much in most other countries of the world. My sister made it clear that our team should not include anyone with visible tattoos. Seemed like a silly rule. What's the big deal? But this is because tattoos in Mexico are symbols of gang membership. They are not hip. They represent evil and are revolting to the common person. And so when we go into that community to serve, representing Christ and the local church there, tattoos will obviously be a severe hindrance. Unfortunately, we did have someone who had a tattoo, a large one, on the forearm. And we didn't know this until we got down there. And it wasn't a tattoo of Jesus. You could almost excuse that, but even in that culture, it wouldn't have flown. And to make matters worse, the one who had it was a girl. Now, we may think, so what's the big deal? They just need to get over it down there. But, you know, again, that's exactly the problem. Our insensitivity to values and customs and cultures of others, that Americans and their way of thinking is superior, that everyone else just needs to get on with the program, and that they should just be grateful that she went down there to pass out blankets. And this is why many mission teams do more harm than good. Yes, blankets are passed out. Yes, churches are built, but often at the cost of alienating the very people that we're trying to reach, alienating them from church and from Christ himself. The screening process must try to catch anything that might prove to be a social hindrance on the part of the applicant. You know, it's a legitimate question. Are there tattoos? Does the male applicant display female mannerisms? Does the female applicant display masculine mannerisms? Okay? We live in a different culture here. We're more forgiving of that sort of thing. But those quirks can be an issue in communities where teams are trying to minister in. Not always, but sometimes. All sorts of things like this. Will the applicant conform to the proper dress codes and behaviors without putting up a fuss, even when such rules don't make sense? You know, are you willing to not wear your hat when you go into somebody's home? It's considered very offensive. So I think you get the idea here. The trip is about them, not us, and we should not object to a proper and thorough screening, and we should be willing to accept a sorry, we can't take you. And just to work this in real quick, while we're at it, if you have a low tolerance for germs and you get sick easily, don't go to a third world country. By all means, do everyone a favor, stay home. All right, finally, we are running a little late, but bear with me here. This one will go through fairly quickly. Number 5. From last week, relief, rehabilitation, or development. Very few mission trips are done in situations in which relief is appropriate. Even when a natural disaster has occurred, by the time the team arrives, it may well be that the bleeding has stopped. Furthermore, most of the time, mission trips to help poor communities are not even done in post-disaster situations, but rather in communities experiencing chronic problems that need long-term development. Even when relief is the appropriate action, a mission team may not be the best means to provide that relief. Again, if there are local organizations and churches and ministries who are willing and able to provide the necessary assistance, it's far better to let them do so, and we can perhaps send those churches money to help them with that. After all, they have the local knowledge about who really is, who really needs help and who doesn't, and they are the ones who will still be conducting ministry there long after the mission team has gone home. The fact is, most locations that mission trips target need long-term development rather than this sort of temporary relief and even rehabilitation. But you just simply can't do long-term development in a two-week mission trip. When we think about mission trips, we think of things like distributing food to the poor, building a church facility, holding evangelistic meetings in the evenings, giving health checkups to all the neighborhood kids, and so on. The push is to do a lot in a short period of time. But again, this relief approach fails to address the actual cause of the poverty itself in that community. To address the cause of the poverty in an economically depressed community requires a lot of time and a lot of expertise, something well beyond the means of a short-term mission team, short-term mission trip. And a big part of that development involves not just assessing the needs of the community, but first and foremost, assessing the assets of that community, what the community itself has to offer to help bring itself out of its own poverty. Equipping local churches and ministries to do this would be a better investment in the long run than spending $20,000 to send a dozen kids to, say, Belize or Honduras to pass out care packages. For instance, if the poverty in a particular community is the result of a false worldview that is prone to economic depression, you know, something like fatalism or another, or some false religion, like one that believes in reincarnation and won't eat the food that's available to them, then it would be far better to channel our resources into evangelistic efforts, followed up with discipleship and sound theological teaching, development, rather than just sending relief over and over and over and over and over and over, as we talked about last week. But all that's another subject which we don't have time to really explore that much today, but it does fit into this whole context of short-term mission trips. So to be clear here, there is value in such trips. I don't mean to convey that they always do more harm than good. That's not the case. I'm not trying to convey that we should never support them or should never go on one. Any apprehensions I projected today are somewhat of a response, what I believe to be a necessary response, to the undiscriminating support that we have been conditioned to give short-term mission trips. Christians, again, are called to be generous, kind, benevolent, sacrificial, giving. Yet with that, we have to be wise and discerning, because not all poverty is created equal and not all mission trips are created equal. In fact, I'll leave you with this. When you look at websites of many of these organizations that specialize in sending out short-term mission trips, about 90% of the reasons given to get you to sign up have to do with how you will benefit from the trip, not how the target community itself will benefit. And that itself is really quite telling. All right, next week, David Stevens, as he already shared with you, beginning the message. Originally it was going to be Nate chickened out, and we got passed on to Nate, to Dave. And Dave, I think you told me that we're going to talk something along the line of metaphysics, something light and fluffy, it sounds like. Is that it? Metaphysics? Huh?
We'll see.
All right, I think that's what you told me, actually. All right. The week after that will be Dr. Michael Bauman from in relation to the Reason to Hope seminar. And then the week after that, March 4th, I'll be back up here to begin our next series, which will be a fairly lengthy one. Spoiled you here with this short one, but the next one will be pretty long. All right, let's go ahead and have the children come in. The singers and the musicians can come to lead us. And let's stand and we'll continue our time of worship this morning.